John Gacy was probably the most prolific or infamous serial killer in modern times.
Police say John Wayne Gacy raped and murdered young men and boys from 1972 to 1978. Before his arrest, he spent nearly a decade living a double life.
It sticks out in people's mind because not only did Gacy rape and kill so many boys in such a short amount of time, but he had everybody fooled.
Cops say Gacy was well-liked in his community, just outside of Chicago. He was active in local politics and would dress up as a clown to entertain children.
The whole case was very, very unique. It was very troublesome to people in Chicago and really across the country.
Gacy was arrested in 1978. When investigators searched his home, they found the unthinkable, more than two dozen bodies.
He concealed the bodies of his victims in his own home, in the crawl space. He had a dirt and rock crawl space where he would excavate shallow graves and place the victims in the crawl space.
Gacy was convicted and executed for the murder of 33 young men and boys. But at the time, investigators were not able to identify eight of those victims.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of Crime Analyst. And with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve these crimes. And we are turning to a new, tremendously heartbreaking case. And I realize that this is another one of those offenders whose name and visage I recognize from popular culture, but whose crimes I was completely unaware of. And I'd certainly never heard of the victims. And so first up, that's the first thing we're going to do. As you know, we do that on Real Crime Profile. We put the victims first. And so here are the victims we know of as sourced by the Chicago Tribune. And first is Timothy Jack McCoy, 16 years old.
Unidentified victim, number 28, white male, 14 to 18 years old.
John Butkovich, 18 years old.
Unidentified victim, number 5. White male, 22 to 32 years old.
Daryl Sampson, 19 years old.
Samuel Stapleton, 14 years old.
Randall Raffet, 15 years old.
Michael Bonin, 17 years old.
William Carroll, 16 years old.
Unidentified victim number 26, white male, 22 to 30 years old.
Jimmy Hakenson, 16 years old.
Unidentified white male victim number 13, 17 to 21 years old.
Unidentified white male number 21, 21 to 27 years old.
Rick Johnston, 17 years old.
William George Bundy, 19 years old.
Michael Marino, 14 years old.
Kenneth Parker, 16 years old.
Gregory Godzik, 17 years old.
John Zick, 19 years old.
John Prestige, 20 years old.
Unidentified white male, victim number 10, 17 to 21 years old.
Matthew Bowman, 18 years old.
Robert Gilroy, 18 years old.
John Murray, 19 years old.
Russell Nelson, 21 to 22 years old.
Robert Winch, 18 years old.
Tommy Bolling, 20 years old.
David Talsma, 20 years old.
William Kindred, 19 years old.
Timothy O'Rourke, 20 years old.
Frank Landigen, 19 years old.
James Mazzara, 20 years old.
Robert Peast, 15 years old.
Wow. That's just listing all those roll call. Boys and young men. Yeah, it's, and you look at their pictures and you see these young guys who, you know, because of who got them, that they went through hell, that they were tricked into a situation where they were then taken advantage of, immobilized, and many of them were tortured, sexually assaulted, and brutally murdered. And then they were buried in shallow graves under JG's house. Unbelievable.
Yes, and these are victims, some that we know of, but of course there are many others that we don't know about. And there's still, it's contested actually, whether either Michael Marino and Kenneth Parker, whether they were JG's victims. So even though we've read out some of the names, we know that this prolific killer would have killed most likely many more, but equally it is contested by Michael's mother specifically, Sherry, whether he was a victim of JG. And I just wonder, our listeners, whether you knew any of those names, because I have to say, I knew about him and I knew what he looked like. And I knew there was this sort of caricature of this clown type image. And I thought that's what the case was about. And then actually, when you start to dig into the case, and we've been following the Peacock series, it's a 6-part series called Devil in Disguise. I realized actually I knew very little about the facts of the case. And this wasn't about someone dressing up as a clown and targeting young boys. And right. That really struck me first of all. I don't know about you Lisa, or Jim. I would imagine Jim probably knew a bit more about it. But I think there has been a misrepresentation and mischaracterization for many years about this case.
Yeah, you're so right. The image that I was saying, it kind of fed into our collective coulrophobia of clowns. And like you say, Laura, it made you think that he was killing young children. And, you know, that turns out not to be the case. Jim?
Well, yeah, this is a case that, of course, I heard about back in the 70s. And then we studied it in the BAU. They found out that one boy that had been seen with him last, and that would be the last victim that we just read, Robert Peast, who was 15 years old. He was taken from a pharmacy. His mother was waiting outside, and he was taken in JG's car to his house, and nobody ever saw him again. And because of that, an actual investigation was started. But what's maddening, aggravating and maddening, is that he would be the 33rd known victim of this serial killer, a serial killer who had a history of being arrested and convicted of sexually assaulting a young boy. And when you go back, and we'll get into this later, about the criminal career of this person, certain terrible things seem to emerge. And that is that when boys, teenagers, and young men go missing sometimes, they're just automatically assumed to be runaways by the police, and no investigation is actually done. And for many of these kids and young men, their families were devastated by them going missing. The police were told this is not somebody who would run away. And yet there was literally no investigation going on. And part of that was because the guy who abducted and killed them was such a charismatic, presented as a nice guy, pillar of the community kind of person, that they just looked right past it. And I know, Lisa, we tried very much on Criminal Minds with episodes like What Fresh Hell to show that the offenders sometimes are the guys smiling in your face. They live right next door to you and you look right past them because you're looking for a monster. Mm-hmm. And people can hide that monster side of them. And this horrible person did that in this case.
I mean, most often they do. And as I was watching the documentary, I'm ticking off psychopathy characteristics.
Absolutely, me too.
Yeah, and I thought you would be too as well, Jim. As our listeners know, Jim and I don't discuss cases in detail before we come on here, so we're hearing each other's reaction. I didn't know Robert Ressler was going to pop up in the docuseries, and it was really good to see Bob. I would have liked to have heard more from him, actually.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting that JG described him as his good friends.
I know. I noted that too. How did you feel about that, Jim?
Well, because he wanted to feel, well, it was part of wrestler's interrogation technique. I mean, he built rapport with
him. So he interrogated him first. Sorry, just to kind of... Oh, okay.
And one of the ways that we learned in the BAU to get some of these serial offenders, horrendous offenders, to open up to us in an honest way is to feed their egos. And JG was absolutely primed for that. He was always looking for attention. He always wanted to get access to people of power. He wanted to present himself as a person of power. He was able to manipulate people very well. And as you said, Laura, the first thing that stands out is that everybody saw him as a charismatic, you know, nice guy. And that glibness that you saw in this documentary series, which always got my hackles up, I just saw it over and over and over again. And in terms of psychopathy, to have the gall to try to sell that other people, that he actually killed one person in self-defense, and then other people must have killed other people and buried them in his house, unbeknownst to him.
Yeah, that's just a BS.
It's just complete, it's unbelievable. So you and I both have worked cases with brilliant psychopathic serial killers. JG was not one of them. He was not brilliant. He did stupid, idiotic things. And he's one of the reasons why, one of the ways that you can show, one of the ways that you can tell that he was not that intelligent is that his lies aren't even believable. They're not even logical. There's nothing about them that actually makes you say, oh, wow, maybe he is telling the truth. They're just such ridiculous absurdities. That is because he doesn't have the intelligence to create something where a jury might scratch their head and say, wait a minute, maybe this guy did get set up. Wait a minute, maybe he didn't do all these bad things. But they're so absurd in this case, it's laughable. I mean, it would be laughable if he wasn't such a deadly killer.
Yeah, although I do think a lot of people did buy into that narrative. And, you know, we don't want to start at the end, which is what, you know, it kind of opens up lots of questions about who did what right at the end of the docuseries. And for me, going back to what we know factually is important. And I think, Jim, you mentioned Robert Peast, and obviously that's the case that investigators did start asking questions when they should have been asking questions way before Robert Peast going missing. But we must remember that we only have his narrative to rely on, even in saying that Robert Peast went into his car willingly and they go back to his home address. And I have to say, I don't buy that at all, because his mother was waiting outside and she said, he told her, we'll go and wait inside the pharmacy. I'm going to talk to this contractor. And it seems very odd, given that he was a very responsible 15-year-old. Why would he jump in a car willingly and go to his house when his mum's waiting there without saying, Mum, I'm just going to go and quickly jump in this guy's car and go to his house? That just didn't seem believable to me, nor did it sound believable, the first, in inverted commas, victim being killed in self-defense.
Oh, that was such garbage.
Rubbish.
And he revealed that because he said, oh, I killed him in self-defense. He came at me with a knife and I took the knife away from him. I mean, I turned the knife on him. And that's how he died. He said, I took the knife away from him. If he took the knife away from him, then the kid is no longer a threat. There's no reason to kill him. It's no longer self-defense. You've taken the weapon away from the person. You've taken the threat away. But he then covered himself. And again, that's what I'm saying. The absurdity of that as a self-defense. And then, of course, when you go from there to, so I buried him under my house. I mean, it's just unbelievable. If the kid actually came at you and you killed him in self-defense, any normal person would say that. If you wanted us to believe it now, why wasn't it believable then?
You Yeah, but I do fear, and I don't know what you thought, Lisa, but I do fear a lot of people are buying into his narrative because it's the only one that exists. And the docuseries does really center his narrative.
It does.
And I've spoken to a couple of journalists, actually, who've reported on the case. They believe his narrative, you know, that he was the first victim, Tim McCoy, which when we go back in time, and we will talk in a bit more detail, but they did find out he had a history, as you said, Jim, a history of sodomy in 1968 of a teenage boy. And of course, there was a living victim and he went to prison for that. And interestingly, he said, it was the only thing I was ever sentenced to, which tells us that there were other things. But of course, the 1968 victim did survive. That's what he goes to prison for. So it makes sense that he makes a decision the next victim won't survive. But his narrative that it was self-defense, he came at him. And I think that that did shape the modus operandi, what happens thereafter. Because as we know, with knives, it's wet work.
Right.
And here was somebody who liked to keep a clean, tidy house. We know that because of the confession when he drew the map of where the bodies were located. He didn't want his carpets being messed up. That was the reason why when he was backed into a corner, he told them where to look. So there's a change in MO as well. But I don't know how questioning, I'm sure Bob was very questioning, and I agree it wasn't a criticism of Bob Ressler because it's part of rapport and trying to establish the truth. But in everything I saw, there seems to be lies, concentric lies,
absolutely,
more lies. You know, there was actually very little truth or authenticity into anything that he said, even starting with the media have misrepresented me. That's why I wanted to talk to you. He was characterized as a clown. He said he didn't like that. And yet he's in prison drawing pictures of him as a clown and selling them.
Right.
And living off the notoriety of that. So even the smaller things become the bigger things. We know he wants the attention. We know it's all about him, his narcissism. But he just can't be believed in anything that he says, can he?
Yeah, well, I think that Craig Bowie says that at the very beginning, that initial, you know, journalist says that he's a master manipulator, he's a liar. And Jay Levine, the other journalist, does too. But to your point, bringing up Rob Peast, I mean, they lay that out, that, I mean, that broke my heart because I can imagine myself picking my son up from his job and him saying, just a second, mom, I have to go do something. And then him never coming back. That is a parent's nightmare. My sons are the same age as Robert Peast. And the fact that it was the mom's birthday, I mean, they really lay it out clear. It was the mom's birthday. The detectives say that the parents knew something was wrong. And that led them to JG. I mean, horrible.
But it is horrible. Just an unending nightmare for the parents. But when we get back to Timothy McCoy, JG picked him up basically at a Greyhound bus station, right? And brought him back to his house. If you look at the facts, if we look at the behavior, this kid ends up dead in this house. When they finally uncover JG as a serial killer, they pull up the carpet in his bedroom and they find a big bloodstain there. And as far as we know, this is the only victim that was actually killed by being stabbed in the chest. And therefore, it's likely that this is actually where it happened. So if you put it in place in JG's bedroom, this is where he's killed. It is much more likely that what happened was JG got him in there and tried to sexually assault him, and he fought back, and JG stabbed him in the process. That is much more likely than just this kid coming at him with a knife and then JG somehow being able to best him, get the knife away from him, and then kill him, and then decide, if you believe JG, decide for the first time in his life to ever do something outrageously illegal, which is then bury a kid that he supposedly killed legally under his house. It makes absolutely no sense. And if you look at, you know, those circumstances, it was January 3rd. Think about it. It is cold as hell there in January 3rd. That ground must have been so frozen under that house. To have dug a grave under there is a tremendous amount of work. This was a motivated offender. He had to have put in a tremendous amount of effort just to dispose of this body, to
conceal this body in what he hoped would be a permanent manner. And this would only be the first of 33 known young men and boys that he would kill. To think that we, as an educated public, would buy into that. And I'm shocked, Laura, when you tell me that journalists actually believe that narrative. What do they say? Why would he lie?
Well, some don't question the narrative, do they? And I'm not talking about those in the show, by the way. I'm just talking about other people who I've talked to, because there's no alternative narrative. I mean, for you and I, we always look at what's viable, what's feasible. We look at the timeline, the sequence. You know, we know in 1968, he goes to prison for sodomy. He serves 18 months of a 10-year sentence.
10 years.
Which he should never have been out, which we will get to. But when Timothy goes missing, as you say, Jim, January 3rd, 1972, he's done his 18 months. We know this is need-driven behavior. We know there will be other victims, most likely. This is the first body that's identified, right, under the crawl space. And as you say, he must have been thinking about it for a long time. He must have been planning it. To dig at that time of year, you're exactly right, it takes commitment. But we know how prolific offenders are, and not always do others question that narrative. And I do believe, you know, it's only his, really, and he keeps centering, or he did keep centering it. It's only his story that people have. We would always question what he says versus what might be the other possibilities. And it's highly unlikely that even with Timothy McCoy, that he was the first victim after he came out of prison, because we know that he'd worked out this sort of MO of, well, these victims, they all kind of deserved it. He blamed them. Mm. They all wanted something from me. And then they tried to blackmail me. So this was just me responding in the moment. You know, he'd covered off everything that someone might think about, of particularly being, as he said, he wasn't homosexual. He said he wasn't gay. He clearly was. I mean,
but
the facts and
gay,
the evidence say that he was.
He was gay and a preferential child sex offender. They are not the same thing. And he actually was clearly sexually attracted to underage boys. And because of his own self-hatred, this drove him to kill these boys so that he wouldn't have to go to jail again. I mean, he got caught very early on in his offending career. He got caught and should have never had access to boys again. But instead, they let him literally manipulate the system, volunteer to do stuff, talk his way into a cushy job in the prison that he was in when he was sentenced to 10 years, and they let him out in 18 months. Why? All he did was rape a boy. Give me a fucking break. And then he runs away, gets out of town, and he goes back to Chicago and starts over again, starts a business. And what does he do? He populates his business with teenage boys, his exact target victim age. So he has all these boys around him, and he's their boss.
But Laura, Jim just said something, that he killed the boys so that he wouldn't have to go to prison again for sodomy. I mean, do you think that's why he was killing them, or was killing them, he killed them because he wanted to kill them, whether or not he was going to have sex with them or not?
I mean, it's a difficult question, isn't it? Because part of me thinks it was his evolution and that he had enjoyed it. And
I'm
if
sure
you torture someone and you enjoy that power and control, there's an element, of course, that he's enjoying it. And I do think he didn't want to go back to prison. He did everything to get out of prison. Although in an ironic way, prison gave him access to young boys and men. So there was probably a part of him, he enjoyed being in the power structure, and he was very narcissistic. But I do think that Timothy McCoy probably did fight back, and there was, you know, that was unexpected, and he did end up killing him. But that method of kill wasn't one of choice. He then thought about that afterwards. And when we hear him in the documentary talking about, you know, the necktie and the strangulation aspects, I mean, he shows complete callous disregard for all the victims in the first instance.
No empathy at all.
No empathy, no remorse. And he clearly enjoyed the whole process. And yes, he had a choice. And I think I liked the way, I can't remember if it was the prosecutor, but someone described Jekyll and Hyde, you know, that you have a conscious choice about your actions and what you do. And he consciously chose to get better each time at what he did so that he wasn't identified. And to have so many victims, and I still believe there are many, many more. There are some who probably are still living. There are some who are probably dead that we know nothing about. I don't even know how many missing young boys across this time period, because if we take 1968 onwards, when he comes out of prison, how many missing boys were being reported? And the police just seemed to blow it off of, well, there were lots of runaways at that time. So we couldn't really give any time or energy to it. But Jim, you and I both know there are runaways where you see lots of history. And then there are those where the parents are saying, it's totally uncharacteristic. We were going to watch a video, or it was mum's birthday. We were doing X, Y, and Z. He was a responsible young kid. He was doing well at school. And there was no antecedents. There's no reason for him to run away. Right. And the frustration for me was just hearing that pattern repeat over and over, and no professional curiosity, no real desire to question what was going on or even look into Rob pieced.
Right. And so some of them had jobs, some of them were in school, some of them, you know, were in relationships, and nobody ever had any indications that they were going to run away. And then you're just not going to, they should have been accumulating all these missing boys and saying, wow, maybe something's going on here. But also, in answer to your question earlier, Lisa, mm-hmm. how he kills is an MO aspect. It's and I believe that in this case, as because it stands out in how this boy was killed, this boy was killed, you know, stabbing. I don't think that's what he got off on. That's an MO aspect of the crimes. MO aspects are typically learned. And it isn't unusual for somebody's first kill to be after they've already been arrested, after they've already done time, and wanting to prevent them, the next victims, from ratting them out, you know, so he didn't want to have to go to jail again. But then there's the ritual aspects, is what he gets out of it. And that is something that the torture, the sexual assaults, the rapes,
keeping those trophies, things, keeping up stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Keeping trophies. Yeah. He had, you know, he had class rings and driver's licenses and the shackles when they searched his place. You know, he had books, Gay Love and then Pretty Boys Must Die. You know, good Lord. It's just, this guy had a fantasy life about killing boys, but I'm sure that he developed the ability to do it, you know, the physical ability. I mean, killing people is messy, and burying bodies under your house, very messy. You know, it stinks. It's hard lugging around a dead body. There's all these things that you have to overcome to do this. So he must have a really strong drive that drove him to do this over and over and over and over again, year after year after year. There's no question that he was engaged in a fantasy life that surrounded abducting, torturing, and killing boys. But that fantasy evolved over time, as Laura said. It's not something that he, you know, would have started with. Otherwise, we would have seen him kill that kid when he was first arrested. He would have at least attempted to. There would have been a string of these attempted murders before he was able to perfect it. But in this case, there is one guy that he basically trapped and raped and beat, and the police just disregarded him.
Yeah, let him go, and the police did nothing.
Nothing. It's unconscionable. And can you imagine to be the victim of such a terrible, violent crime, and then watching the guy who did it to you just walk free and be able to live his life, and then you're being tormented by it? It just brings to mind Cosby and all his dozens of victims that he took advantage of and raped and sexually assaulted. And now he gets to walk free on a technicality.
We should just say that that victim was Jeff Ragnall, who was abducted, raped, and beaten, and then let go and was just ignored. And until he saw Gacy's house being taken apart, then he knew finally people would know the truth.
Yes, I mean, we know with most cases, there are near misses or there are those who get away. And I think it is interesting that Jeff Ragnall does manage to, actually, he doesn't get away. He's actually dropped back at the place where JG picked him up. And I think his account is very interesting because he says that he did get into the car willingly to smoke a joint. But then he believes that JG put chloroform over his mouth and that's all that he remembers other than waking up in a house and being tortured and raped. Now, the question is, well, why did he survive? Why was he then taken back to the original location where they met? And we don't know enough about it. But I think the very fact that he reported, and when you see what he looked like, he had very clear visible injuries.
Right.
Was clearly tortured and abused. And the police didn't really take him seriously, didn't really invest in the investigation. It was actually he and his partner who located JG. So they then turned investigators and found him. And my goodness, I mean, another huge opportunity to do something about a very prolific and dangerous man, and they miss it completely. But what I will also say is that that happens in so many cases where women are raped too, where they report and some have injuries, some don't. But quite often, they're not believed, they're not taken seriously. And
right.
It's just so frustrating because you know there are opportunities to prevent these dangerous perpetrators from escalating.
Think about victim F. I mean, give me a break. It's the same thing that happened. The police made a decision about a crime, a very violent crime, that it didn't exist. And because of that, the offender then went on to go after more people. Fortunately, there was a real cop out there who was able to stop the guy. That should have happened in this case.
But we go back to the concept, don't we, Jim, of worthy victims. You know, someone making a decision about who's worthy and who's not. And that just makes my blood boil because there were so many opportunities. And in each case that we've talked about, to prevent someone from going on is all they get, the killer, the rapist, is the green light. Just carry on. Just keep doing what you're doing. And of course, JG should never have been out anyway. So I don't know even at that point why the history wasn't joined up. And I do get fed up of just hearing law enforcement say, well, we didn't have computers then. Because lots of times with cases, there isn't a computer. It's what's going on in your head, actually, that makes the biggest difference, doesn't it? Okay, there might not be records. But even in this case, there were records that went back to 1968 to the sodomy offence. Mm. And there was a very clear diagnosis that JG was a sexual psychopath and that he was always going to be a risk and he was a sexual predator. And I don't know enough to know why that wasn't joined up when Jeff Ragnall reported and when they tracked down JG. I don't know why those dots weren't joined again. But I do think oftentimes it's just attitude. An aptitude, and it's not seen as a worthy victim or a worthy case to put your time, energy, and investment into. And it's not just disappointing. It has resulted in many young boys being brutally tortured and killed. There are grave consequences.
Right. Well, we have so much to talk about this series on Peacock, as well as this prolific, horrific serial killer. And we're going to have to come back next week and continue this discussion. We're going to tell you as much as we can about the victims, as much as we know of. But unfortunately, because of the lapse in time between their disappearance and their discovery, 7 of these victims, possibly 8, have not even been ever identified, even though this happened in the 1970s. 50 years ago. It's unbelievable. They've never been identified.
Yes, and let's talk about that in the next episode. And just so our listeners know, we are wrapping this one, but when we have to number a victim, it's very dehumanizing. You know, that's someone. And I'm not even going to say it's someone's son. he was someone, and just to be a number. It's really soul destroying, actually. It's such a horrible way of having to describe an unidentified white male number 28. But we can only go on what there is. And obviously, if people Google, you want to look at the cases that we're talking about, that's how police identified them when they were taking the bodies out of the crawl space. But it really is dehumanizing. And I still wonder, well, how many others are missing persons that we just don't know about that are out there? And that's what Sherry Marino was saying about her son. She believes that Michael is most likely dead, but knows nothing more because it was believed that JG was the killer. But she, her instinct, everything from her as a mum says that he most likely is dead, but not the body that the police are claiming is in the grave. So it must be incredibly traumatic and distressing for those who know, but also for those who just don't know, who have no answers. And I'm not going to say closure, because there's no closure. There's never closure. You learn how to exist in a new realm.
Yeah,
and not knowing what happened to your son who just disappeared, and no one else is helping you trying to find out what happened, must just be absolutely horrific. There's definitely grounds here for a proper reinvestigation, but let's get into that in the next episode. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
The Case of Sally Challen, The Teacher's Pet, Lynette Dawson, The Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.